Hi, you're listening to my favourite Elliott Smith song. This is the podcast that's all about keeping Elliott Smith's legacy alive in our own very small way. And we do that by speaking to well-known fans about their favourite song of his. So hi and welcome to episode 27. This one's actually going to be the last one for the first series, but I'll explain a bit more about that after the interview. Today we're speaking to Jim Fairchild. Jim plays in Granddaddy alongside our episode 14 guest Jason Lytle, as well as in Modest Mouse, and he releases music on his own too. He became friends with Elliott when they toured together following the release of Figure 8, and they continued to stay in touch after that. At later shows, Elliott would even join Granddaddy on stage, and Jim would visit him at New Monkey Studio when he was trying to fix old equipment. In this interview, recorded in Los Angeles by Elizabeth Wood Stanley, Jim shares some great Elliott stories and goes in depth on his favourite song pick as well. This feels like a fitting way to end the first series, and I hope you'll enjoy it too.
My name is Jim Fairchild. I am a musician. I play guitar in Modest Mouse and Granddaddy, and I do a bunch of stuff on my own. My favorite Elliott Smith song is Happiness, and it's not only my favorite Elliott Smith song, I think that if I had to cite a favorite song ever written and or recorded, it would be the same song. For me, the song Happiness pretty much ticks all of the boxes, both in terms of listening to a song for pleasure, but also as a musician, it being fascinating enough melodically, structurally, chordally, it still fascinates me. And then also lyrically, like, I think one of the things that I know that one of the things that's most attractive to me about Elliott's songs is that the songs are dreams. You know, there are very definitive moments which ground the story and consequently the listener in reality. But then there are so many details that could split any number of different ways that I think employ subconscious elements. I mean, Happiness is, in a way, a story song. You know, like, he does establish some pretty firm details. Cops standing down the road, turning traffic away, told him that he shouldn't upset her. Those sorts of things are, like, those elements plant it, I guess, kind of firmly in a narrative song. But then, you know, the dude just, like, the song is such a beautiful magic trick. In that, talking about the body being buried below, what I used to be will pass away and then you'll see. There's the finality of the first verse, which is, well, his body been buried below way back in the day. But then closing with this sort of rebirth, the coda, which he repeats, I think, three times and then another half a time. You know, so maybe those, or maybe the death that's referred to at the beginning of the first verse isn't a final death. And I really like that subject, you know, that people, or that theme rather, that people are constantly, you know, being born and passing away. I think that is a constant thing. It's something that when I sit down and make up words, I mean, sort of unwittingly, I realize that I'm always wrestling with and finding joy in the constant renewal and also passing of this existence. There's nothing she could do until after, when his body been buried below, way back in the day. Oh my, nothing else could have been done, made his life a life song. I could probably write a PhD thesis on this song, but when it's like, made his life the lie, you know, that can be a part of, like, those realizations. I'm just sort of spitballing here, but those realizations that, oh, this is not my truest self, you know, I need to move more toward it. I think he's probably dealing with some of that stuff. Her memory working in reverse, like thinking about the future, which is one way that could be read, you know, like moving toward what you, or the person or the woman in the second verse, hopes she can become. I just really love those sorts of details. But again, none of that stuff is, he doesn't really ever define it as such. He doesn't like name the people. He doesn't even really name the circumstance. As close as you get is the cop standing out in the road turning traffic away, which again could touch back on memory. It could be like the internal, whatever sort of internal monitoring situations we've erected for ourselves to like chase away the bad and bring in the good, or maybe it's not as direct as that, but you know, like those sorts of parameters and barriers that we are constantly dealing with to make our decisions and make ourselves new and allow the old stuff to go away, hopefully, you know? I told him that he shouldn't upset her, and that he'd only be making it worse, involving somebody else. But I knew that he'd never forget her, while her memory worked in reverse, to keep her safe from herself. The chords are incredible, that principal melody, that hook. I don't know if Elliot gets a lot of credit for just having like these simple, almost like they're riffs, you know, like da dum da dum da dum da dum da dum da dum. Like that is such a powerful hook. You could, anyone who hears that one time is going to remember that forever. That's another thing too, is like, and the chords that he's working with underneath that are pretty insane. It's not an obvious chord sequence in any way. It gets a little more like traditional when he starts singing, but to just have that wonderful hook over such a complex chord sequence, that sort of stuff as a musician is just endlessly fascinating to me. Like, it's a Lennon McCartney, Harrison did it too, you know, like he gets some chromatic stuff in there. There's also some sort of Paul Simon stuff in there. Most times when musicians attempt, or maybe not attempt, most times when musicians hand the listener more complicated ideas, they sound like exactly that, complicated ideas. And Paul Simon definitely comes to mind there, but Elliot was just, he was the master of that, where particularly that, the intro chord sequence, it's a insane chord sequence.
But it comes across as simple. Like it comes across as so very simple.
It's so beautiful and lullaby-ish. And he just had such an insane grasp of composition and melody.
It's one of those songs, I think, really, with a lot of Elliot's songs, where there's tutorials on how to play the song, you know, which I'm not a musician, but, you know, obviously leads me down that road of seeing how complex his songs are, and that people are, musicians are drawn to them in that sense, as far as just wanting to learn how to do the complexity of the song, which is fascinating.
Yeah. Well, you know, like, there's not that many people who have done that trick, you know what I mean? Like, there's the sort of more simple songwriters, in the sense of, like, the way that they deal with chords. I guess Springsteen comes to mind, maybe like Edge and Bono, who I love listening to that stuff, but generally speaking, their chord sequences, they wring a lot of information out of very little structural underpinnings. But I think also a big part of like what is so compelling about Elliot's music and why it is like ineffable in a big way is that there is so much movement there, but he does manage to make it simple. And again, like, that's just not, it's not an easy thing to do. Most of the time if you're dealing with a chord sequence, like, this is a tune down. I'm sure I'm screwing this. Like, with that complicated of a, there's only a few chords in there, but there's a couple of them that are just really weird. And like this one, that's a very like 1-3, what is even happening there? 1-3-7, like that's not a, and then this, whatever, even, I don't even know. what that chord is. Anyway, most of the time if people, you know, if a composer is going to give you those chords, it's just going to sound kind of dopey. But he gets that super simple ba-dum, 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 ba-dum. That melody is just so grounding. Just for me, Elliot, he just ticks all the boxes. And again, happiness really just, it hits everything. I mean, I can remember the first time that I heard this song, because this was the first single from Figure Eight. DreamWorks put out a, like, you know, there were still like advances, advanced singles and stuff like that. And I went up to Amoeba, I was still living in Modesto when Granddaddy was, the first iteration of Granddaddy was still happening. And I went up to Amoeba specifically to get that CD single. That was 18 years ago, or more than 18 years ago, it was almost 19 years ago now. This song hasn't really aged to me, you know, and we toured with him on that record, and so I watched him play it. I mean, it was in the set every night. I watched the set every single night. I saw it perform live probably 25 times or whatever in that 5 weeks. And it often means different things to me, but the allure of it has never faded.
So I spoke with Jason Lytle this past summer, and he mentioned that you introduced him to Elliott Smith. He told a story where he said that you guys were in the airport and you were listening to Figure Eight, and you were saying to Jason, you've got to listen to this, and you made him listen to Everything Means Nothing to Me.
Yeah.
Do you remember this story?
Totally. Yeah, absolutely. We were... Jason and I were always the people who did the press in Granddaddy, like did all the interviews, and we had just gotten done with a software slump, and we were on a promo tour. We got this advance from the Dutch office of V2, and I was just sitting there with my headphones on, and Jason and I, you know, we were a mess then. We were always in bad shape, you know, and I remember being super, probably, you may not want to hear this, Orson, but drunk and hungover at the same time, and in the airport in Amsterdam, and I was listening to that on headphones, and that song came up, and that's another one where the just like chord sequence is insane. His piano playing is like full on virtuoso style in that song, and then those drums kick in, and I was blown away. And you know, Jason and I were both still are super into recording, so. I remember like taking the headphones off as soon as it got done and just going like, you have to hear this. This song is insane. And also, we were probably a little cynical and a little like catty in a way, I think. To just be that demonstrably like flattened by the first listen to something to the point where it's like, dude, you have to hear this. That didn't happen that often, you know?
So what was it like when you guys actually did get to tour with him?
Well, it was great. I mean, we had met a few times before that. I think the first time we met may have been, there was a show that Granddaddy opened for Quasi and Pond in Portland in the summer of 1996. He was always really shy, but very sweet. And the first time he and I actually ever hung out was at the Columbia Hotel in London in the summer of 1998. And it was when Quasi was his backing band. And we hung out a little bit that night and had drinks together and had laughs, and it was fun. But we were never buddies. Like, we never got each other's numbers or anything like that. And then I don't like want to put myself certainly in the same category as Elliot, but I didn't feel like there was a ton of music at that time that we could relate to as peers. I felt, you know, from whatever distance, I felt like it was like Home, which was a band from New York, originally from Florida, us, Flaming Lips, Elliot, Super Furry Animals, maybe like the Beta Band. But there weren't a ton of contemporaries who I felt like were trying to, Wilco was in there too, but trying to push it as much as we were trying to push things. So you always have those hopes that, like, you know, we're gonna encounter these people at some point and they're gonna be great. That's not always the case. Often those hopes are dashed and just people aren't as cool as you wanted them to be. But Elliot was just, he's the coolest dude, you know? He's just such a gracious person and really fun. And certainly that 5-week tour really was the beginning of he and I becoming better friends. And he loved everybody in the band. He was like, he also wasn't one of those dudes who like only liked Jason or whoever. He was like just such a gracious person. Was really just loving to all five of us, and that meant a lot to us because we were such a kind of gang.
Did you continue to stay in contact with them after you guys toured with them?
Yeah, I made sure that, you know, we were in contact, and then I spoke to Elliot a number of times on the phone, maybe exchanged a couple of letters even at that point, you know. And then about 6 months after we got done with that tour, we were playing a couple of nights at the Troubadour, and Elliot, he loved the song called He's Simple, He's Dumb, He's the Pilot, which is the first song on the Software Slump. And Elliot loved that song, and it was a very personal song to him. And he would address the audience. He'd be like, he was just the greatest dude. He'd be like, you know, thanks for being here. Hopefully you saw Granddaddy. Don't buy my merch. Buy Granddaddy's merch. And he's like, and make him play the Pilot. Tell him to play the Pilot. But we never did on that. We had never learned it. It seemed like a song that there's no way we'd be able to pull it off. So I remember I said to Jason, I was like, well, we should start doing it. And Jason was apprehensive. And he's like, if Elliot will sing the high part, which is this section of the song where Jason says, did you love this world? Sorry about that bad singing, but he's like, if Elliot will sing that, if he'll come up and sing it, because the Troubadour was like right at the beginning of the tour, then we'll do it. So we learned it. And he's like, but does anybody have any contact with him? I was like, yeah, I talk to him, you know, fairly often. So I hit him up and I was like, would you do it? And I remember it being this really incredible moment because I don't want to go too deep into the darkness of Elliot, because I think it's an important maybe part of his story, but it's not the most important part. And I think people make it out to be that too often. But anyway, it would have been 6 months really since he had been seen, you know, that tour ended in like November, and you know, whatever was happening in his life, he maybe didn't look the greatest on the run that we did with him. And then around LA, like, definitely rumors were flying, you know. And then he showed up at the Troubadour and he sang that part with us, but we didn't like announce it or anything. That's like an 8-minute and 50-second song, and that part comes in at like probably close to 7 minutes or something like that. I don't remember exactly, but he just like, the first night he just crawled out on the stage. He actually crawled out from the, you know, Troubadour upstairs dressing room. And then everybody was like totally shocked. Like, I mean, there were for sure people who were like, he's still alive. And he sang it wonderfully. And then he came out and sang it a few more times with us, like on different tours. Like he flew up, he did a little bit on that tour. And then he like flew up to Seattle and did it when we were supporting Coldplay a few months later. It was magical when he was around. He's just one of those people, you know. He was just like, even if things were kind of dark, which, you know, you can't pretend like that wasn't sometimes the case, but, you know, I always really, really enjoyed my time hanging out with him. I mean, you know, there's tons of stories that I think of when I think of what he means to me in my life and as a friend and positive influence. I guess that's kind of it, you know. Just he's been gone now for more than 15 years, which is so crazy to think about. But you know, I really do. I miss him often, and I reflect on his his presence and his contributions to my life and other people's lives, like on a pretty regular basis. Like, he's a person who I have a tremendous amount of love for still, and I still, even though I only really spent like a few years being his close buddy, he's still a person who I reflect back on often as a big force in my life, positively.
So thank you then to Jim Fairchild and Elizabeth Wood Stanley for that interview. Now, as I mentioned before, this is going to be the last episode for a few months. We wanted to take a bit of time to freshen things up, book some more great guests, and bring you some even better episodes. It's been 15 months now since our first episode with Louis Theroux, which is quite an unconventional series length, I'll give you that. But it's also a good point for Elizabeth and me to take a little break before we come back again in April. So I just wanted to end by saying thank you to all the guests who've taken part in the series, to all the people who've helped us arrange interviews, and to everyone who's been sharing the episodes. Particular mentions to all involved with Heaven Adores You, New Monkey Studio, and Sweet Adeline, just to name a few. But most of all, thank you for listening to it. It's been lots and lots of fun, and we're already really looking forward to coming back in a few months. See you then.